Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at mathworks.com.
On Point is a production of NPR and WBUR Boston. The program is made possible by your financial support. Please pledge online at WBUR.org.
From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Jane Clayson, in for Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. Senator Chris Dodd wants to be president. He's already spent 6 years in the U.S. House and 27 years in the Senate. A Washington outsider he is not. But in an election where experience might really matter, Dodd says he's your man. He has a long family history stretching back to his dad's days as a prosecutor at Nuremberg, which he's drawing strength from. We need to uphold the rule of law, Dodd says, and to restore America's moral authority. His candidacy is now a cause, a long shot maybe, but Chris Dodd is hoping you'll listen. Up next, On Point, Chris Dodd, U.S. Senator, presidential candidate. Joining me now from Hartford, Connecticut, is Senator Chris Dodd, Democratic candidate for President of the United States. He has also served in the Senate for 27 years. He sits on the Senate Foreign Relations Committee and chairs the Banking Committee. He is a former Peace Corps volunteer and a U.S. Army reservist. He's just written a book about his father's time from 1945 to 1946 as a prosecutor at the International Trial of the Nazi Leadership. It's called Letters from Nuremberg, My Father's Quest for Justice. Senator Chris Dodd, welcome. Nice to have you with us.
Nice to be with you as well. Thank you for having me on.
We'll talk all about your new book in just a moment, but I'd like to start with the big news of the day out of Washington, Senator. As you know, President Bush vetoed a $35 million expansion of a popular children's health insurance program. And I wonder what your response to that is, Senator.
Well, it's disturbing and troubling. This is, I think, most Americans, regardless of ideology or politics, recognize that of all of our citizens, children deserve to get a good start in life. And one of the ways of doing that is making sure they get good health care. And obviously, we need health care, universal health care for all Americans. But in the absence of that happening, the very least we can do is take care of our children. As a father of a 6-year-old and a 2-year-old, and knowing how fragile they can be, my 6-year-old has severe allergies, here food allergies as well as environmental ones, and how worrisome that is. Now, we have a good health care plan. I'm a United States senator. Senators get wonderful health care plans. Congressmen get wonderful health care plans. The president has a marvelous health care plan. The idea in this country, with all of our affluence, what we're talking about here is basically, over the next number of years, it would be 3 months in Iraq. That's the cost of Iraq each month, about $10 billion. Just to put it in perspective for you, I know there are those who think we're doing the right thing in Iraq. I happen to disagree with that. But to put it in perspective for you, the president has decided that 3 months in Iraq is not worth providing the kind of health coverage that children ought to be receiving in the country. So I'm terribly disappointed by it, and I think there's a good chance we'll override the veto.
Well, let's listen to the president speaking about it yesterday. He said that the proposed children's health care expansion would cover families earning up to $83,000 a year, and he said it looked like an effort to federalize health care. Here he is in Lancaster, Pennsylvania, yesterday talking about the veto.
There's about 500,000 children who are eligible who aren't signed up. So I said, why don't we focus on the poor children rather than expand the program beyond its initial intent?
Senator Dodd, you've spearheaded child care legislation. You've sought funding for early childhood education. You expect there's a compromise here? Or I hear you say earlier you expect to override this.
Well, I think there's a good chance of doing that. We'll see when the votes are. I suspect an awful lot of Republicans feel as I do here. This is not an issue that divides people along ideological lines. And I point out to the president here, we're talking about at $83,000, that sounds like a lot of money, but we've watched health care premiums go up 87% in 6 years. So in addition to those who are not covered, even those who have coverage today, the cost has become prohibitive here, the cost of insurance to cover these cover children, cover families. And so $83,000, while a number of years ago may sound like a lot of money to a family out there working, that family may be working 2 or 3 jobs, have 2 or 3 children. And the idea that we're going to say that's just too high, too costly, again, I would suggest otherwise.
Also news today that Senator Pete Domenici, 75-year-old mm-hmm. Republican senator from New Mexico, is retiring. He has a progressive disease that affects the brain. What's your reaction to the senator and the potential impact on the complexion of the Senate?
Well, first of all, Pete Domenici is a friend of mine. I know this finds people find this awkward to hear Republicans and Democrats talk about actually getting along with each other. But Pete Domenici has been a wonderful friend, his wife Nancy. I live about two blocks from him on Capitol Hill, and my wife Jackie and our children on numerous occasions have gone and have dinner with him on weekends or Sunday nights. So I'm going to miss him on a personal level. He's been a good senator. We disagree on a lot of issues, but a very good senator and one who's represented his state well over the years. And so I'm feeling for him and his family right now. He's been an advocate. Pete Domenici was one of the strongest advocates for mental health parity issues, which I had admired him immensely for, sort of stepping out of his own party and advocating a coverage for mental health that very few others were willing to stand up and advocate for. So on a personal level, I'll miss him. Obviously, it creates an opportunity for Democrats. In fact, I've written a press release today, and I've called my friend Bill Richardson and strongly urged Bill to run for that Senate seat. I would take one less candidate out of the presidential contest. I'm not sure he's going to accept my offer, but I thought I'd just raise it with him anyway.
Well, speaking of the Democratic presidential race, there's been a lot of talk, of course, about the war in Iraq, and you have been critical of your fellow presidential candidates on the Iraq war. And I'd like to ask you about that for a moment, sir. In a recent debate, many, including Hillary Clinton, said that they could not commit to getting troops out of Iraq by the year 2013. What is your plan, Senator Dodd?
Well, first of all, I found that rather stunning comment. I mean, that's 6 or 7 years from now. And the idea that a Democratic candidate for president would have any hesitancy about doing what we could to remove the get the military out of Iraq was rather remarkable to me. It was almost breathtaking to hear every leading candidate make the same statement. They would not make that commitment. The job of an American president is to keep us safe and secure. That's the first responsibility that you must assume. And certainly it's true of senators as well, but particularly true of the president, as commander-in-chief. And I don't know of anyone who believes that our present policy in Iraq is keeping us safer or more secure or less vulnerable, less isolated in the world. In fact, quite the contrary is true. I think most people agree today that we are less safe and secure, a lot more vulnerable, and a lot more isolated, that's for sure, in the world. So I believe that the present policy needs to radically change. And if we don't change it, then I think it's going to be harder and harder for us, not only in Iraq, not only for the Iraqis, but also in the conduct of foreign policy globally. So I see no value and merit in continuing a policy that's just not working. We're turning Iraq into a petri dish for jihadists and terrorists. My view is, of course, to utilize the other tools in our arsenal here, and that is diplomacy, politics, economics. We have major military, huge military facilities in Kuwait and Qatar. Here we have wonderful relationships, or good ones anyway, in the Middle East with a number of countries there. The idea that the only means by which we can create space and opportunities for the Iraqis is to continue having a military presence for the next 6 or 7 years at an astronomical sum to our treasury, not to mention the loss of lives, hollowing out our military. At this very hour, 88% of our army is not prepared to be combat ready. The National Guard and Reserve forces have been depleted. It's having a harder time to recruit the best and most competent people to remain in the Guard and the Reserves, not to mention in the military generally. So I'm very concerned about this and very disturbed that Democratic candidates who received the majority in the Congress last fall with a vote last November because of Iraq, primarily because of Iraq, and to watch Democrats walk away from this at a time when there are alternatives, much better alternatives for us, was very disturbing to me.
Let's listen to the New Hampshire Democratic debate last week, where Senator Hillary Clinton was asked by Tim Russert about her views on ending the Iraq war. She spoke after Senator Barack Obama replied to a similar question that it would be, quote, irresponsible to project what might happen in 4 years or so.
Senator Clinton, Democrats all across the country believed in 2006, when the Democrats were elected to the majority in the House and Senate, that was a signal to end the war, and the war would end. You have said that you will not pledge to have all troops out by the end of your first term, 2013. Why not?
Well, Tim, it is my goal to have all troops out by the end of my first term. But I agree with Barack. It is very difficult to know what we're going to be inheriting.
Senator Dodd, do you think Hillary Clinton is tracking to the political center on this issue? Is she waffling on the issue of Iraq?
Well, I'm not going to try and second guess her motives or that of Barack Obama or John Edwards. I just know all three had the same answer to that question. And again, there's an assumption here that I think is false, and that is our continued military presence in Iraq has some potential benefit either to the Iraqis or to ourselves. I totally and fundamentally disagree with that. In fact, we've said from the very beginning that there was no military solution in Iraq. All we were going to do is create space, aside from getting rid of Saddam Hussein, create space for a for reconciliation between Shias and Sunnis and Kurds. That was the primary function. Well, that reconciliation has not happened, despite the Herculean efforts of presidents and generals and members of Congress who traipsed over to Iraq one after another here, begging them to try and get their act together politically, the religious leaders to do so as well. No one has succeeded in that. In fact, the Iraqi leadership took a month off this summer as a way of sort of toning things down, I guess. And the point I'm making here is that I don't see any benefit to this and why you'd be hesitant about suggesting that you're going to maintain a military presence in Iraq when I frankly think there are other means of helping to provide that stability without remaining militarily present in that country.
Senator Dodd, I'd like to ask you about your race for the White House. At the present moment, you don't register in the national polls. I'd like for you to sketch out for us how it's going to work to get from where you are now to the nomination and then to the White House.
Well, first of all, we're still some 3 or 4 months away from the first caucuses or primaries, at least that we hope that to be the case, although this is sort of a movable feast. You never know exactly when these caucuses are going to occur. And basically polling data in these races has – national polling has little or no significance in my view. Based on previous history here, if you go back even 4 years ago, at this – about this time, John Kerry, who of course, became the nominee of our party, I think numbers – national polling numbers were somewhere in that 2 to 3 to 4 range. He was almost 30 points behind Howard Dean in a race that would occur in the Iowa and New Hampshire primaries. In fact, on December 23rd, 2003, between Christmas – almost around Christmas time, I think he was – John Kerry was like 19 points behind Howard Dean and 4% in the polls nationally, 2 points behind Reverend Sharpton. 4 weeks later, he became – he won the Iowa caucuses and went on to win the New Hampshire primary. And, of course, to win the Democratic nomination. Now, every fact situation is different, clearly. But that's not been unusual in the past. In fact, Iowans and folks in New Hampshire have a wonderful habit of trying to prove the pundits wrong, proving predictions wrong. We have a very good operation in both states. So we have very good people on the ground. The endorsement by the International Association of Firefighters, almost 300,000-strong membership around the country, was the most coveted endorsement, I think, over the summer, in that this is an organization that not only endorses you but then goes out and really works for you. They've been very active and very aggressive. In fact, they were one of the only organizations to support John Kerry in 2003 during his run-up to the nomination process. So I have a lot of confidence and faith about where we are, and I believe that most people are still undecided. We've made almost 70,000 calls to likely caucus-goers in Iowa and about the same number in New Hampshire. And almost 80% of the respondents claim and tell us that they're undecided at this point.
So what do you make?
Very uneasy about electability and very uneasy about governance.
So what do you make, Senator Dodd, of Hillary Clinton's rise most recently in the polls and in fundraising? $22 million raised in the third quarter. 53% of Democrats now say apparently they want her to be the nominee. What's your response to that?
My response is that money doesn't always win these things, and celebrity doesn't always win it. Again, Howard Dean, I think, had $70 million to John Kerry's $20 million. Money didn't win him that nomination in the end. In a place like Iowa and New Hampshire, they judge you on different criteria than how well-known you are or how financially well-off you are.
But is it possible in the world we live in today to run against big celebrities with lots of money, to actually run the kind of campaign that, say, Jimmy Carter did 30 years ago?
Well, we'll find out. I mean, again, we're raising more than adequate amounts of money. We thought we'd need around $20 million to run effective campaigns in New Hampshire and Iowa, to some degree, obviously, in Nevada and South Carolina, which come early as well. We've been doing that. We have 11 offices open in Iowa, some 60 people on the ground working. In New Hampshire, a smaller number and fewer offices open, but nonetheless a strong presence there. And again, getting good reaction, good endorsements by people who are following the race closely. And it depends where you sit here. If this is merely attending a sort of an athletic contest and trying to pick who'll win in January in the caucuses, then that's one approach. If you believe that we ought to be talking about not who's leading in the polls but who ought to lead, not who's winning but who ought to win or who can win, then I think you get a different reaction. And that's the reason the firefighters made that unanimous endorsement of their executive committee. They were not unfamiliar with the polls at all. They knew what the polling data was. But they made a decision based on experience, on background, on the ability to win elections as well as the ability to bring people together, which I think is a major issue in this campaign, and that is who has the proven experience of succeeding in bringing Democrats and Republicans together on critical issues. I did that on child care. I did it on the Family and Medical Leave Act, which took me 7 years and 3 presidents and 2 vetoes to bring Republicans and Democrats together, and 50 million Americans have taken advantage of that law. I did it on election reform and financial services. I did it in Latin America, where I served in the Peace Corps, working on the Central American issues. Mm-hmm. Those kind of successes, I think, mean something to people when we're desperate to get out of this endless political screaming at each other and have political leadership that's truly interested in bringing Democrats, Republicans, and others together.
Let's listen to an Iowa voter now who's on the line waiting with a question. Jeremiah is in Davenport, Iowa. Jeremiah, hello. You're on the line with Senator Dodd.
Yes, Senator Dodd, my question is, in Iraq, with the redeployment you're planning, is that going to be, are you planning something immediate or something gradual? And after that, would you be planning to keep us as a world police, or would you, our foreign policy change in regards to that?
All right, Jeremiah, thank you, Senator.
Well, first of all, we voted even yesterday on matters in the Senate that would begin redeployment and complete it by next June. Russ Feingold offered the amendment, which he has on numerous occasions, which I strongly supported in a speech I gave on the floor of the United States Senate yesterday. And so you can move out about a division and a half per month. That's what our military planners tell us. So I would hope we wouldn't have to wait till 2009. We're not coming up with the votes yet, but my hope is in the coming weeks that those vote margins will grow and that people realize the danger of persisting in this policy. If, however, on January 20th, 2009, that I'm in the White House, as I would hope to be, then my plan would be to start that redeployment soon after that, do it carefully and safely over a number of months, obviously, to make sure that our troops are going to be there. I've advocated that there's a limited role, I think, for training, as well as for dealing with some of the terrorist organizations that may still be operating there to protect U.S. installations and our embassy there, presuming we still have one. So there's a limited role, vastly reduced from the 160,000 people we're talking about. And I would begin that process and hopefully complete it within a matter of months here while pursuing aggressively and robustly the other avenues available to us to help achieve that stability in Iraq, which is fundamentally a political issue, not a military one, in my view. And secondly, to make sure we build the relationships in the region so that we don't find ourselves with a growing or more chaotic situation than the one that already exists. Hard to imagine it being much more chaotic than one that's been we've seen develop over the last 2 or 3 years.
Jeremiah, thanks for the call. Senator Dodd, I'd like to turn for a moment to your very moving book, Letters from Nuremberg, My Father's Narrative of a Quest for Justice. Your father, Thomas Dodd, Democratic senator from Connecticut, he was also one of the lead and many say perhaps the sharpest prosecutors at the Nuremberg trials. How did you decide to publish this book now?
Well, first of all, I had to find the letters. I didn't know they existed until a few years ago. They were actually in a box in my sister's home in Providence, Rhode Island. And my brother turned them over to me a number of years ago and read them for the first time, which was an eerie setting. The very first time I sat down to read these letters, having spent several days organizing them chronologically, I wanted to read them in the order in which they were written, and they were rather jumbled at the time. But the date I sat down to read them was July 28, 1990. The first letter my father wrote to my mother was July 28, 1945. Hmm. It was 45 years to the day, so it was an eerie moment, unintentionally occurring that way, and then held these letters for a number of years. Last year, when the Congress passed the Military Commissions Act, and today we hear the news, the leading headline in the New York Times this morning, secret U.S. endorsement of severe interrogations. The Military Commissions Act, of course, abandoned habeas corpus, allowed the president to use extreme measures in interrogation, and we walked away from the Geneva, or a good part of the Geneva Convention. Not to mention warrantless wiretaps, the politicization of the U.S. Attorney's Office and the like. The critical thing about Nuremberg, and the letters, first of all, this book has a value on three levels. One, they're the lost art of writing a letter. And my father wrote to my mother every single day at Nuremberg.
And love letters.
15 months.
Yeah, not just letters, love letters.
Love letters. So if you want to read just the art of a good letter, this book, you may enjoy the letter just on that level alone. Secondly, it's the only – there have been many good books written about Nuremberg, but this is the only one I know of where you're getting a contemporaneous view as the events unfolded here. This was no certainty that Nuremberg was going to work. In fact, it was rather presumptuous when you think of it. The war was over just over a matter of weeks, the war in Europe anyway. It ended in April. Roosevelt died. We had a new president in Harry Truman. Europe was just a mess for obvious reasons, been destroyed. The city of Nuremberg had 30,000 people buried in the rubble of that city when the trial began. Mm-hmm. Hardly any infrastructure to accommodate it. Here, four nations, the Soviet Union, the British, the French, and the United States, gathered together, giving lawyers to 21 defendants at Nuremberg here was rather presumptuous. But the key point here, aside from the presumptuousness of the idea, was the difficulty in convincing people that the rule of law and civility was important. Winston Churchill wanted to summarily execute the defendants at Nuremberg. The Soviets wanted a show trial for a week and then just execute them. And why not? 55 million people died, 6 million Jews were incinerated, 5 million others faced a similar fate because of their ethnicity or their politics. Why in the world would you possibly want to give these thugs a trial? But because of people like Robert Jackson, the Supreme Court Justice who was the chief prosecutor there, Sam Roseman, who was the chief speechwriter for Franklin Roosevelt, Henry Stimson, the Republican member of the Roosevelt cabinet, who was maybe the strongest advocate, said, no, we're different here. We're going to prove to the world that civil nations can deal differently. We're even going to give these people a rule of law. There was the great sentence at the opening of the Jackson presentation at the court, which I memorized years ago, which says the following. It says that four great nations, flushed with victory and stung with injury, stayed the hand of vengeance by voluntarily submitting their captive enemies to the judgment of the rule of law was the greatest tribute that power ever paid to reason. It's a remarkable sentence, in a sense. And really, the value of this book, I wouldn't have written it just because I wanted to publish love letters or even a history of Nuremberg as that unfolded. The value to me is in the third part of this, and that is exactly what we're talking about in our headlines today. The rule of law. And we're watching an administration and a country beginning to retreat from its moral high ground. And I think it's costing us dearly both at home and abroad on the false assumption that you and I have to make a choice. We can be more secure, but we're going to have to give up our rights to achieve that. I fundamentally and totally disagree with that. It's one of the major reasons I'm seeking the presidency.
Well, let me ask you more about this, because in the book you seem to contrast the idealism of the past with the moral issues, some of which you described just now, that we face right now. So I guess how did your father's work at Nuremberg affect your own career, especially now as you are running for the president? You speak of this moral high ground. How has it impacted you?
Well, it's part of my DNA, I suppose. I mean, I grew up with this. I was only a year old when my father went to Nuremberg, but I can't – the countless evenings around a dining room table when my father would talk about these issues and with his six children. And it affected – he says in one of the great letters that he wrote to my mother in June of 1946 at 38 – he was 38 years of age – he said, I'll never do anything again as important as what I'm doing here. Rather prophetic statement for someone of that age to make. And yet, while he had different jobs along his career in life, this was his career in a sense. This was his epiphany at Nuremberg. It affected every other decision he made, the issue of human rights and the rule of law. And he communicated that with his children over and over and over again. And so while he died some 40 years ago, both my parents did, that notion of the rule of law, I walk around every day of my life and have for 26 years with a copy of the Constitution and the Declaration of Independence in my pocket, given to me by Robert C. Byrd, my seatmate on the floor of the United States Senate. I don't think there's anything more important for us as a generation than to continue and defend and protect these rights which have sustained us for more than 200 years. And I'm deeply concerned that we're moving away from it. I know it's not the biggest issue of the day, but I think it's the most important issue of the day and one that my father cared about deeply. He imbued his children and those around him with that notion. And so this book, I think, has some value beyond, as I said, letters and history, the importance of the rule of law, standing up for it and fighting for it. Remember, it was from Nuremberg. It wasn't just a trial. It was the most important trial of the 20th century. And from that experience, the Marshall Plan, the UN system, NATO, the IMF, the World Bank, all of these structures and the architecture which we led on, we built, the United States did, we now have an American administration that belittles them, talks about the Geneva Convention as being an antiquity, belittling and demeaning the UN system with all of its shortcomings and foibles, and Lord knows they have them. But the idea that we'd walk away from the very institutions we built at a critical moment in our history, I find very disturbing and worrying, and one of the reasons I'm running for office.
I'm Jane Clayson. This is On Point. We're listening to Senator Chris Dodd, and I'd like to take a call now from Clive, Iowa. Mary Beth is on the line. Hi, Mary Beth. Go ahead.
Hi. Hi, Senator Dodd. I heard you speak here in Des Moines not too long ago about the very topic of the Nuremberg trials and your dad. It was riveting to listen to. And what struck me was when you said that how unpopular the trials were, because they were expensive, unnecessary to many people, and somewhat divisive. And yet, these are exactly the same reasons that we're hearing for not pursuing impeachment charges against our own administration now, when they too have moved away from rule of law and really insulted the Constitution. It seems to me that Congress has a responsibility and duty to defend the Constitution and pursue impeachment.
Mary Beth, thanks so much. Senator Dodd?
Well, people have raised this issue, and let me just say, while I understand the motivations behind it, and there are deep concerns I have with the administration, if we'd embark on that course at this juncture, that's all we'd do. Having been through the impeachment process with President Clinton, it is all-consuming. It sucks all of the oxygen out of the room. And I think right now it's going to be very important for Democrats who, for the first time, with a minor period in the last 15 years, have been given 14 years, been given an opportunity to lead in Congress. And I think there are critical issues that the American people want us to address. This is one of them. I don't minimize this at all. That's why I'm talking about it. But there are other issues as well. And if we have any hopes of winning the national election 2008, retaining, I think, the majority in the House and the Senate, then to digress into an area that is highly divisive in the country at this point here, I think could set us back. So I respect the emotions behind the caller's interest in impeachment, but my own view is, and I've said this clearly to others who have raised it, at this juncture I would not support such an effort.
Another question for you, Senator, from Pam, who's in West Hampton, New York. Hi, Pam. Go ahead.
Oh, thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
Senator Dodd, I would like to ask you, if you became president, would you get rid of all these illegal things that Bush has passed against our Constitution, like get rid of the Patriot Act and all the rest of the stuff that he's put his hands on? And also, what would you do if he bombs Iran?
All right, Pam, thanks. What about the Patriot Act, Senator Dunn?
Well, I've said, we've been asked, you get in these debates, you're given sometimes 5 seconds to answer a question, which is not exactly a debate format. But nonetheless, when I've been asked the question, Jane, what's the first thing you would do on January 20th, 2009? And the answer I've given is I'd restore the Constitution. And there are a number of areas where I think we have to do it. And again, we're witnessing here these secret agreements here, secret documents and opinions that were issued by the Justice Department endorsing the harshest interrogations techniques ever used by the Central Intelligence Agency. Those sorts of things need to be changed, in my view. And as president, I would do it by executive order wherever I could. Some of it may require acts of Congress. Here, the Patriot Act would require an act of Congress to deal with here.
There's a caller now from Manchester, New Hampshire, who's got a line of questioning along the similar topic. So, Ann, go ahead. Ask your question for Senator Dodd.
Hello, Jan. What a
Hi.
Privilege to ask Senator Dodd about the Seymour Hersh article in the current New Yorker regarding the administration's plans for a surgical attack on the nuclear installation in Iran, supplemented with our Navy cruise missiles and even maybe ground forces. Is the Seymour Hersh description accurate, if the senator has had a chance to read it, and his comments on the administration's plans? Thank you, Senator, and good luck.
And thank you, Senator Dodd. You sit on the Foreign Relations Committee, among other things. What's your answer?
Well, first of all, let me apologize to Pam. She did ask about Iran, and I apologize to her.
Well, we ran out of time.
The point.
So, yeah.
I'm aware of the article by Seymour Hersh. In fact, I know Seymour and have great respect for him in many areas. And I can't corroborate the details of this. This much I do know, that clearly, in my view, the administration is involved in a drumbeat here. We saw this the other day with a resolution offered on the floor of the United States Senate, which gets precariously close to drawing us into Iran militarily, in my view. I think it's noteworthy. Only 22 of us voted against this. My colleague from New York, Senator Clinton, voted for the resolution, much to my disappointment. When you have Dick Lugar, the Republican former chairman of the Foreign Relations Committee, Jim Webb, the former secretary of the Navy under Ronald Reagan, Joe Biden and myself voting against it, it ought to tell you that there's a great danger, in my view, in providing the fig leaf of 76 members of the United States Senate, Democrats and Republicans, endorsing the notion without a single hearing, without any knowledge of where the administration is going in all of this, not to mention for the first time in our nation's history to decide we're going beyond sovereign states, which is what states deal with, and decide we're going to name specific organizations within states as terrorist organizations, took us to a place we have never been before, and it's dangerous, in my view. There's no question that this administration sees military options as the way to solve all of its problems. That's been its history. Now, lately, we've seen a change of mind in North Korea after 6 years of refusing to engage in the kind of bilateral talks which have brought us far more success in North Korea than anything the president was recommending earlier. But in Iran, we see no indication that the administration has any willingness to move in a different direction to deal with the very legitimate issues that Iran poses. Maybe I should have said at the outset, look, I don't misunderstand that Iran poses dangers, either supporting terrorism globally or the potential of accumulating nuclear weapons which endanger allies and ourselves as well. They need to be addressed. But that arrow, drawing that arrow out of your quiver before you've exhausted the abilities to try and resolve those matters otherwise, is dangerous. The use of military force is the failure of every other option of working. And as president, I would not draw that arrow out more quickly than it needs to be, or even unilaterally here. It needs the kind of cooperative efforts that we're seeing being made by Europeans and others to convince the Iranians through one means or another that this is the wrong course of action to be following. So I can't say whether or not I know whether or not there's specific plans being made by the administration to act unilaterally militarily in Iran or not. But I'm deeply, deeply concerned there are those who clearly want to take us in that direction. And the resolution adopted by an overwhelming majority of senators, much to my regret last week, is giving this president and this administration an imprimatur of approval, which I think is dangerous, and I think it was wrong for my colleague from New York to vote for it.
And thanks so much for the call, for bringing that up, Senator Dodd. I'd like to cross the aisle for a moment, if I might, to talk about the Republicans for a moment. When you listen to the GOP presidential candidates, what do you hear? Who's gaining traction? Who's the strongest candidate?
Well, it's hard to say. They have a different set of problems. I think most Republicans can't decide who to vote for because they're not overly impressed with any of them. I think on the Democratic side, there's a general feeling that these are all pretty good candidates that we have here, and therefore the difference of not making up your mind is not a lack of respect for the candidates, but rather the difficult business of choosing between qualified candidates, or at least several of us being qualified. And the Republican side, I think they're all trying to be Ronald Reagan to one degree or another, and they're facing a very difficult time achieving that. Each of these candidacies brings a liability that's not difficult, or rather difficult to overcome. So I don't see any one candidate dominating at all. The numbers for each one of them are relatively low, and no one seems to be walking away with this. So I think it's very open-ended, and I wouldn't be surprised that someone like a Mike Huckabee, who's only at 8% in the polls at this point, may do a lot better before this process is over. Again, someone who's not showing up well in the national polls, someone who's not as well known as Rudy Giuliani or Mitt Romney or certainly John McCain or Fred Thompson. But again, I think an example that people are looking for alternatives and choices that may not be getting the attention nationally but are resonating with people at a local level. And Mike Huckabee is doing that in New Hampshire and in Iowa. And so I would not be surprised to see someone like him emerge as the nominee, much as I might suggest someone like myself, who's not as well known, I think have a better chance than the national media and the national pundits would indicate.
Let's go back to the phones now in Middletown, Connecticut. Dan is on the line. Hi, Dan. Go ahead.
Hello, and hello, Senator Dodd.
Good to have a local voice.
A different issue, if you don't mind.
Sure, please.
Health care. I'm a merc, and I used to work for a big corporation, and like a lot of baby boomers, I got riffed, and I'm trying to start my own business, and health care costs are preventing me from building a business. Just for my wife and myself, I'm paying $26,000 a year for health care. And it's breaking me.
Dan, thanks so much. Let's turn it to the senator. You know, we've heard a lot about health care from Senator Clinton, Barack Obama, even John Edwards, all with their detailed plans. But we haven't heard much about it from you. What is your plan, and how is it different?
Well, Jane, first of all, let me invite your listening audience here on ChrisDodd.com. We detailed and have months ago a very detailed health care plan that we spent a lot of time developing. That's true of our energy plan, environmental plan, which are rather bold plans, by the way, here. And I invite people to look them up and to go over them. And so let me just say I'm a strong advocate of a universal plan that's completely portable. It models itself on the federal employees' health benefit package, which I talked about a moment ago. That is that every federal employee has. It's a good structure. If it's good enough for members of Congress, we ought to be willing to share that idea, a plan that's in place that works. I deal with prevention, chronic illness, administrative costs, all of those details which will reduce cost. It's not just accessibility. It's bringing down cost. I mentioned earlier an 87% increase in the premiums for health care in the last 6 years. And so Dan in Middletown here is facing what many people are, and that is the staggering rise to afford this product, a product you need to protect you and your family. Here, this is the point that makes a difference here. You can look at these plans, and many of them are good ideas and a lot of similarity one to the next. Here's the difference. We've been at this. In 1948, Harry Truman offered the first universal health care plan in this country, and nothing basically has been done about it. We talked about the S-CHIP program for children. Which of these candidates was seeking the presidency has the demonstrated ability to bring people together around controversial issues and get something done? It's what I've done for 26 years. It's what I'm known for in the Senate by Republicans and Democrats as one of those members who actually knows how to build those bridges that bring people together. I did it on family and medical leave. I did it on child care. I did it on autism, premature births, infant screening, after-school programs. I did it with Head Start. I did it in Latin American issues in the Central American wars. I did it on campaign finance reform. In every one of those issues, I did it with a Republican. And every one of those bills, my major sponsor, other than myself, was a Republican, because it wasn't going to happen if I didn't do that. And health care, I will do the same. And so the plans vary to one degree or another here. You could glaze over the eyes of the most determined listener. Universality is critical, bringing down costs, dealing with prevention. Portable plans are essential, but we also need political leadership that can do this once and for all. Or we'll be back here 4 years from now, I promise you, Jane, and you may have another candidate on, and you'll be asking them the same question because we didn't have political leadership that knew how to do what I just described.
Thank you, Senator. Susan now calling from Ames, Iowa. Hi, Susan. Go ahead.
Hello. Thank you. Hi, Jane.
Sure.
Senator, thank you
Good
for
morning.
Running.
Yeah.
My question deals with the public financing of elections. We already know that the obscenely costly run for the presidency makes citizens cynical and even contemptuous of politics. And I know so many of us are tired of our candidates beholden to well-connected financiers. We would like a system, we citizens, where money matters less and we matter more. I'd like you to talk, Senator, about where you stand on the Durbin-Specter bill that's called the Fair Elections Act now.
Susan, thank you. Fair Elections Act, Senator Dodd.
Well, I'm a strong co-sponsor of it, and I'm not a Johnny-come-lately to this issue. I know others are just discovering these issues. For 26 years, I've been an advocate of public financing for campaigns. I agree with the caller more than she'll ever possibly know. This is very disturbing to me, and she's absolutely right in this. When people see, I mean, with all due respect here, we have candidates raising $70, $80 million to run in primaries in four states. With populations, Iowa has a population of 3 million people, New Hampshire less than that here. What are we possibly talking about with a system that's gone so haywire? What it does is a number of things. One, it limits the number of people who might even think about doing this. Now I'm not talking about running for the presidency. I'm even talking for running for any public office. So we're shrinking the pool. At the founding days of our republic, and you had to be a white male that owned property to run for public office. Today, de facto, not de jure, but de facto, we're creating the same kind of limitations. And secondly, the radiating effect of this going out to the public, where it's so discouraging to people to see that the kind of resources being raised make it very difficult for people to have much trust and faith in the process.
And yet, Senator Dodd, you do take a lot of money, contributions, campaign contributions from the mm-hmm. banking and finance sector.
Well, yeah, look, I'm an advocate of public financing, but I don't believe in unilateral disarmament. If I'm going to be a candidate, I have to raise the resources to campaign effectively. So, but given the choice here, believe me. In fact, I remember 1993, Bill Clinton was calling around to offices and asking people what he thought the agenda ought to be, and very early in 93. And I thought he might call. And I remember writing down on a piece of paper in my apartment in Washington that if he called, what I was going to recommend. And he did call. And the recommendation were three words, campaign finance reform. I floor managed the McCain-Feingold bill of campaign finance reform. So believe me when I tell you, as someone who's sitting here today looking at candidacies that are overwhelming in their financial resources, we're not doing badly. But the fact of the matter is, and you've raised this yourself, Jane, how can you compete effectively when a handful of people can raise the kind of money we're talking about here? So I just want to say that as president, given the opportunity, not only would I be a co-sponsor of Dick Durbin's bill, but I would do everything possible to see to it becomes law.
Let's go back to the phones now to Providence, yeah. Rhode Island. And Kevin, who's on the line. Kevin, go ahead.
Yeah. Hi, thank you very much. Hi, Jane.
Sure.
Hi, Senator Dodd.
Hi.
I'm going to shift gears a little bit, and I wanted to ask you about executive privilege. This administration seems to be making great use of its executive privilege, and especially perhaps in the form of signing statements.
Yeah.
I wanted to know from you, Senator, if you were to become president, how would you deal with executive privilege in signing statements?
Well, right, first of all, signing statements are unconstitutional, in my view. I mean, I hope at some point we're going to have a challenge to all of this. This takes the constitutional principle of the balance between executive and legislative power to new levels. We've seen in the past administrations try to grab more power at the executive here, but this is a grab that's been unprecedented, in my view, in my service during the last 26 years in the United States Senate. I think signing documents are wrong. There's a value to legislative history that the courts look at, and they do look at and should look at the legislative history when a law is enacted to determine what the intent of the members of Congress were when they drafted the legislation. To sit there and take that idea and extend it to the executive branch and say that the president, when he signs a law, will give you what his intent was, is to completely change what the theory and practice was in legislative history. So I'm opposed to it, would never engage in it, and believe this balance of power is necessary. Look, it's cumbersome. We all know this. If you're going to design a system of government here and you want it to be totally efficient, this is not the one you'd pick. But our founders were more interested than efficiency here. They'd been through a system where an individual, a strong king, had dominated their lives. And so we have spent 200 years growing to that more perfect union, still short of it, but with the idea that people have a right to decide not only who leads them, but also to have a direct say in how laws are going to be shaped. This, a grab for executive power, is distorting that relationship, and I'm opposed to it.
Kevin, thanks so much for your call. I'm Jane Clayson. This is On Point. We are speaking with Senator Chris Dodd. And Senator Dodd, in our last couple of minutes here, a couple of personal questions for you.
Yeah.
You're a 63-year-old father. You mentioned your two little girls, Grace and Christina.
A late-blooming father.
A late-blooming father. And for many years, by your own admission, you lived quite a bachelor life.
I was a bachelor. I don't know, quite a bachelor life is a different word.
Well, dating Bianca Jagger and Carrie Fisher, among others, which leads me to ask, in this day and age, how much of a candidate's private life is fair game? How much should it be a factor in how we judge a candidate and if we vote for them?
Well, obviously, it is what it is. And whether or not you like it or I like it, it's irrelevant. It's going to be there. It's part of the deal today, and you just got to learn to accept it. And so people are going to do that. How much of a judgment to people place on that? I think less and less. I think at a time in the past where people would, for shock value, would bring up some things. But today I think people really are deeply interested in whether or not you can lead this country. Look, I had a woman say to me, Jane, not long ago, that made me very angry. She said, Senator, what you don't understand is America's best days are behind her. And I remember getting angry when she said it to me and angrier when I thought that probably more people agree with her than I'd like to admit. We want to see our country get back on its feet again. We want to feel good and positive and optimistic. I mentioned my little girls. Grace was born 2 days after 9/11. And believe me, as a first-time father looking at her and know the world had changed 48 hours before, I made a determination I was going to do everything in my power to see to it this child of mine was going to have as many dreams fulfilled and opportunities available to her as any other child in any other generation should have. And we need to get our act together in this country and get on our feet again, both at home and abroad, to build the relationships around the world, start investing in the human potential of this country instead of draining our treasury in a war of choice that I think is hurting us terribly. Leadership is necessary to do this. I'm not as well known. I'm not as well healed. I know that. But I have a lot of faith in the people of Iowa and New Hampshire and these other states as they make an early choice that they're going to listen to someone who brings experience and value and results on working with some of these issues and give me a chance to be heard and possibly support my candidacy, because I think that kind of leadership is what the country is looking for.
Connecticut Senator Chris Dodd is running for president. He is the author of the new book, Letters from Nuremberg, My Father's Narrative of a Quest for Justice. Senator Dodd, I appreciate your time today. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Jane, very, very much. I've enjoyed it.
You can continue the conversation, listeners, and download the On Point podcast at our website, onpointradio.org. I'm Jane Clayson, in for Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.